Bonjour, hola, and hello, everyone. Welcome to Oysters Distributed Discussions. Join me, Allie Green, and a special guest each week as we elevate the conversations around all things remote work. We will move away from basic tips and dive in deep, having discussions around current remote work challenges, solutions, the future of work, and social impact. So grab a drink, go for a walk, or pull up a chair and enjoy this week's episode of Distributed Discussions. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Distributed Discussions. Today, we have Joe Palmer. Joe is the founder and managing director of Pointer Remote, an Australian-based company that supports rural communities, businesses, and individuals to leverage remote work. They run a remote work jobs board, deliver capacity building programs with government and community groups, and they are currently building a decentralization tool to encourage people living in metropolitan areas to relocate to rural towns. I love that and can't wait to hear more. Joe is motivated by the social and economic benefits that remote work provides for marginalized parts of the community. Thanks so much for joining us today, Joe. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So before we get started, I'd love to hear a little bit more about where you're dialing in from and how has remote work or remote life played a role in why you're there?
Sure. Well, I am based on a farm about halfway between Sydney and Melbourne and inland, so in rural Australia. Remote work. Look, it's been a process that has sort of evolved for me. I'm a teacher, a primary school, like elementary trained teacher, and I taught for nearly 10 years in schools in Australia, in the UK, and in North America. When I sort of got back from traveling around, I knew I didn't want to live in a city. I did lots of city time while I was away, and I'd gone to boarding school in Sydney, and I'd lived in Sydney as well as London and Vancouver and places around the world. But I really sort of fell into the remote work space. I started a company 8 years ago where I had a still quite education based. I had a comprehensive learning centre that we were operating in three towns, and so I had teachers working for me, and we ran tutoring and school holiday programs and like camps and science days and those sorts of things. And it was sort of my first experience managing people that way. So I had 30 staff over three towns that sort of are about 300 kilometers from each other. So it was quite a physically distributed team. But I also learnt in that instance, like all the whatnots to do. It's like I didn't do a particularly good job of managing everyone at all. But that sort of then led into, I ended up running an event management company in the agricultural industry space with a business partner. And we ran the company remotely from both of our farms. She lives about an hour north of me. And then I was talking with some friends actually at a barbecue, and I'd said, oh, it's going to be fabulous. As this business grows, we can just start hiring my girlfriends who have married farmers and who aren't working, and they can come and work for us. And this friend said, you know, that's a business in itself. And that was how business number three started. So we've been going for 4 years this month, actually. It's our birthday, 4 years in March.
Happy 20- birthday.
Thank you, my third child. So, yeah, we started as a sort of, I guess we had a bit of an identity crisis in that we weren't recruiters, but we weren't a full-blown jobs board. We were sort of that in-between. We onboarded job seekers. We sort of vetted them. We made sure that their internet connection was a decent strength. Like that's still a major problem for a lot of people in rural Australia. And they had a decent phone service and those sorts of things. And with the businesses as well, we were sort of working with them to see how remote ready they were. That, has evolved into all of those other bits and pieces that you said in the introduction. So it's definitely been a process, and each of the steps and things have evolved along the way. But obviously things have sort of gone into a new ultra level in the last 12 months. So it's definitely been interesting.
It's been an interesting year for everybody, but it's amazing that for 4 years you've been, you know, trying to find ways to make sure that people and companies are going to have good working relationships. And there's a few topics you brought up that I want to dig into later, like the connectivity and what that means. But before we jump into that, I'm really curious. So you've had these three businesses all in different facets of industries and with different people. What have you learned about remote work that transcends like a particular industry or transcends a certain specific team? Because it sounds like from your first experience, like there were a lot of lessons learned. And if you could go back and do that over again, like what would you change or how did you evolve to become a better remote business for businesses two and three now with Pointer Remote?
Look, to be honest, you know, I'm very much one that doesn't do regret. I don't sort of do that. I don't go down that rabbit hole.
That's probably the better lesson here for everyone listening.
Yeah. I very much try and take the attitude of, wow, that was a learning experience, wasn't it? I think the things that were very apparent to me very early were the systems and processes that needed to be put in place. And for me to be able to give that autonomy to my staff, especially the ones that I didn't see regularly, there was one of the towns was a 2.5 hour drive from me. And I probably only went a couple of times a year to go and see those staff. And it was fine. And actually, as far as the user experience, like our the families that we worked with and those guys never were aware of me spinning my tires behind the scenes. Like it was quite a smooth experience for them. But yeah, lots of things, making sure that, yeah, those systems and processes that just for anything that was repeatable, it was, those were the things that we sort of, things came unstuck if I didn't have a system or a process for it that my team knew where to get to. And it was very apparent that we needed everything to be cloud-based. Like this is, like I said, this is 8 years ago. And I know that that sort of doesn't actually seem that long ago, but also seems a lifetime ago. But it was still, for someone that had never run a business, I was a classroom teacher. I'd never been in an office environment. I'd never been in a corporate environment. Like I'd never done any of this. I'd never been in even in management or leadership positions at school. So it was definitely lots of learning from all aspects of it. But I think that being organized and being able to give my team access to what they needed, especially because I was working in the business as well, and it was a really tricky business in that we, like I said, 30 staff that were one-on-one or group tutoring with kids between 3 and 6 PM in the afternoons. Like if they had an issue, they couldn't ring me because I was with a family or a student as well. So like it was a really kind of tricky spot, but it was also really good because it gave my team, they were very good at solving problems themselves. So I think that's something that came out of it as well, is like giving them enough trust and support and those sorts of things for them to be like, you know what, let's go with this. We can sort this next time if it doesn't work. Like, and Joe is not going to bite my head off if I do this and it's wrong. And I think that's probably why it worked and why I was able to get away with things being quite unorganized for a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about these points, because even like 8 years ago or today, technology and the tools available to us have clearly evolved. And I see so many companies and people ops people and remote workers like debating what tools they want to use or how excited they are for like Slack versus Asana versus Monday versus Notion. But what you're talking about is like the very basic behaviors. Like you need a system. It doesn't matter like what that system is. It just needs to exist. People need to have access and to know how to use that system. And then you need to like trust that once you have let the bird out of the cage, they can fly. Over the 8 years, like, have you noticed anything new come up or like additional qualities that you would say makes a company successful in remote working when you're now thinking of like how you evaluate if a company's ready to bring on remote employees?
Mindset is probably my go-to. So if I think about the organizations that we work with Pointer, that look, if I talk pre-2020, so for the first 3 years that we were going, we had almost this scale of businesses that used us to advertise jobs. And so there were those ones that had been doing remote for years and weren't referring to it as remote. Actually, that's an interesting point. Because I'd spent a lot of time in North America, everyone worked remotely, like at least once a week, like it was a big thing. And even for me to start a company with the word remote in it was a real challenge for at least the first 18 months here, because in Australia, the word remote very much refers to the outback, so physically remote. And people, I genuinely, until March last year, I still would have to start every presentation, every workshop explaining what remote work was, like literally till 12 months ago, because people like would, we would get a lot of people approaching the business looking for, say, a nursing job in a remote Indigenous community, or they would come to us looking for a mining job, again, in outback Australia. And so just even the terminology around it was really interesting. So that's something very big. I don't have to explain what remote work is anymore, which is good. As far as things around like mindset, like I said, the companies that we had at the start were the ones that were already doing this and they knew it was fabulous and they were like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You're tapping into a talent pool that we haven't experienced before, we haven't had access to before. So they were on board, rolling with it nice and quick. Through to the other extreme where they were businesses quite often in rural towns that had been trying to fill a job for 3, 6, 12 months by trying to pay a relocation package. They tried to up the wage. They would do all sorts of sort of sweeteners to try and attract someone physically to their town. And then sometimes they'd eventually get them there and they'd then leave 12 months later because the town was too small, or they'd left a partner in somewhere else, or they just didn't feel involved in the town. And so those businesses would come to us very much as like a last resort. They're like, we've tried everything. They throw their hands in the air. Okay, let's try this remote work thing because someone's told us about you. And then we'd be able to give them amazing candidates straight away. They'd hire them within a week. Like, it was amazing. They're like, this is great. But then in 6 months' time, that person we'd placed in that business would ring and be like, this is diabolical. There is no systems and processes in place. There is nothing that includes me. I get left out of meetings. I haven't met any of them in the flesh. They just, all of these things that a lot of businesses in a crisis situation found themselves feeling these sorts of things as well, is because they didn't have the systems and processes, but they didn't also realize or place value on that culture piece and that involvement of the human that you've hired as a human, not just as someone that is doing work autonomously that you can't see and that you actually forget about. So that was the spectrum that we've worked with and everything in between. Yeah, it's I think the mindset of the leadership and the manager, that's like a really big thing that I think is really sort of important and is a maker and breaker of this.
Yeah, and it's not just the mindset of like, oh, this remote work thing or hiring a person who can work online for us. It's not even a mindset of like, is this a good idea or a bad idea? Because I love this example of like, okay, well, we can't attract people to this town for jobs, so let's hire remotely. Like, there's an obvious benefit for a distributed teammate, but then forgetting the mindset about culture. So it's like the mindset has to be all throughout the process, not just the decision to hire someone, but also the decision on how to treat that person.
100%. And it goes through until they leave the organization. And what if you're doing that right and the mindset is right, then they stay for a long time, and that's a long time in between. But yeah, you're right. You've nailed that. Like, that's a really, I think people see them as two separate things when they can't be. Like, it needs to be completely intertwined from the start all the way through.
Yeah, I think that's hard for companies of all sorts. Like, I know there's always a debate on people operations teams of like, when does the hiring process end and the onboarding process begin? And it's like so hard sometimes to have that conversation, because it's like, well, there shouldn't necessarily feel like a beginning and end. It should just like smoothly transition into each other. But like, tactically, how do you do that? Which is a whole separate conversation.
And I think as well, like we spend most of our time these days is with that small to medium-sized business that, well, look, it's like, well, I suppose like with organisations, especially at that size, you pedal away and you absolutely are flogging yourself until you cannot not hire someone. You have to hire someone because you are so flat out. But then by the time you've made that decision and you are finally okay with the parting with money to get work off your team's plate, you don't have the time to do that onboarding thing properly, or they don't prioritize. I shouldn't say they don't have time. Everyone has time to do it if you're going, you make the time. If you value it and if you place value on that in your organization, the time appears. I think that that's what also we see that a lot of the time. They start the hiring process when they're at breaking point. And I get it. I'm a small business. Like that being able to justify with yet another wage when it's scary and it's hard. But then, yeah, that time that goes with it, like you've got to invest that time with anyone, whether they're working remotely or in your office. Like that investment at the start is how you get longevity. It's how you get return on investment on that investment into your business. Like doing that, all that stuff properly is all very good in theory.
Yes. And then making it happen in practice depends on some of the things that you mentioned, like ensuring that there is that system and the people know how to navigate it so that the onboarding time is spent on like genuine connection building, not reviewing things that someone who you hire who is autonomous to be a remote worker could be autonomous enough to like figure out if there's the right documentation for it or if they have access to a tool. I think it's quite funny at this stage of, you know, remote work has really only been a worldwide term for the past year, but even a year in, to think about like things like how could someone start and not have access to like the communication tool the business uses. Like those are the mistakes that I think will make or break the experience for remote candidates.
Agreed. But you know what? I know plenty of organizations where there's not even remote work involved and people will have the first 2 weeks without even a laptop yet. And they're in the office and they are just sort of wandering around aimlessly, learning how to use the paper filing system. Like it's bonkers. So I don't think, while I agree with you completely, it's definitely not like just remote or hybrid organizations. It's like organizations everywhere. And I think getting sent home with 24 hours notice with your whole organization was like the biggest spotlight on organizations that were like, we have no systems. We are paper-based.
Yeah, it put a magnifying glass on everything. On the flip side, I want to talk about candidates and communities. So I know Pointer Remote does a lot of work, not just with individual people, but also thinking through community impact. What does a good candidate look like? What does a good community look like that wants to offer more remote work or attract, you know, distributed companies to hire people that live where they live?
Well, I would see a candidate and a community, like just as far as how we sort of define and use the terms and things in our organization. I think looking at a candidate first, what does that look like? I think you can Google how to work remotely effectively now, and there's 70,000 articles and hot tips about the ergonomics of your desk and your ability to work autonomously and to be organized and to manage your time and your workflow and all of these sorts of things. So I think all of those sorts of things I agree with. You've got to hire people that are good self-starters. You've got to hire people that can communicate well verbally and written. God, that was great communication there, verbally and written.
You have to be understanding that, like, you can understand someone even if the sentence isn't laid out perfectly. I've learned that a lot living here in Spain as someone who does not speak Spanish. And I'm like, can I just put enough words together that you understand me? Like, that's good enough. That can be good communication.
my coffee might be an iced coffee, but whatever, there's coffee, there's caffeine. but as well, how you asked about communities, it's something that we've been really, where we've sort of, look, like I said, in the last 12 months, there is information overload, I feel, online, and it's quite overwhelming. I find it even overwhelming as well. And what I found overwhelming over the last 12 months, which is something that I know a lot of people in the remote workspace prior to COVID, because while it was happening, it was still a relatively small world. And like I got to know a lot of people that were doing lots of really cool stuff in different parts of the world, and that we have become friends and speak on each other's podcasts and have met them at conferences, like in person and like online and all of those sorts of things. And so I think there are experts are a dime a dozen these days. And so where we're really in the last 12 months is that we've really chosen our space is going to be really focusing on how rural communities to start with in Australia, but I see this as something that is transferable to other parts of the world, but how rural communities can really use, like, leverage remote work to grow. So to attract new populations, but also to retain the populations that are already there. So as with lots of countries around the world with a educated rural base, so where sort of access to tertiary education is relatively similar to that in metropolitan areas like it is in Australia, we have a huge brain drain to the cities that's been a challenge for centuries, I think, in some places, definitely decades in Australia. But what we're seeing now is that with this newfound flexibility in people's jobs, that they're realising, hang on, I live in, for Sydney, for example, is one of the biggest cities in the world geographically. It's something like, I don't know, 75 kilometres across, like one sort of from the centre out to the western suburbs or something. Don't quote me on the distance. It's big, whatever it is. It's a big geographic space for the 3 million people or whatever that live there. But a lot of people would commute for an hour and a half, 2 hours into the CBD for a non-client-facing job and then turn around and do the same thing in the afternoons. And people were just sort of like, hang on, after lockdown, they were just like, I don't need to do this and this is ridiculous and I don't need to pay this mortgage and I don't need to miss out on everything family life-wise. I don't need to be feeling exhausted on the weekend because I've literally commuted for 10 or 12 hours this week on top of my 40 hours of work. Let's go west. And they are moving and we are having in some rural areas like a housing crisis, like our bigger regional centres. So our farm is about half an hour away from the biggest inland city in New South Wales, which has got about 60,000 people in it. So it's still quite small when you're talking about other parts of the world. But houses are selling at like the day after they go onto the market. There are no rentals. Like there is this mass exodus from metropolitan areas into these regional centres. And what we're really trying to see is that how do we get people to not just clump into these other little mini cities, how do we get them out into those towns that have got 5 to 10,000 people, which have still got beautiful schools and communities and sporting clubs and all of these sorts of things. But they're the ones that lose the, when I talked about the brain drain, they're the ones that would originally have lost them to a regional centre or a city. How do we keep them there? But then how do we also attract people to keep going that 100 kilometres further?
Yeah. And what are some of the strategies that you see are working in that encouragement of people moving to other areas?
I think like a lot of parts of the world where people are going, that is nothing apart from just the luck of where those towns are physically is to the coast. So those coastal towns where you can buy a house that's walking distance from the beach is, again, through no planning or anything to do with anyone's forward thinking, only the fact that they built towns next to beaches, that's been a big thing. But as far as the towns that are really are seeing things that are happening is that they are embracing what it means to have new people move to their town. So I know like in a lot of rural areas across the world, that clickiness and that, oh, they're an outsider and that new person thing is a real thing. And people will come and they're like, well, we lived there for like 3 years and we made two friends because everyone else had been there their whole life and they didn't need more friends, so they just ignored us at the supermarket and they sort of didn't talk to us on the edge of the football field, like that sort of thing. That's a real thing. So you see towns that have really embraced what it means to have a new family move to town, and they're the ones that then tell their friends. And, like, it's incredible. There's a town that's about an hour north of me and it has about 6,000 people that live there, and you cannot get a park in the main street. It is bustling at all times of the day, every day of the week. There are hardly any vacant shops in the main street. There are three schools. They've built a co-working space. There is a 74-spot childcare centre. They are just really embracing what it means to have new people come, and they use that as a marketing tool to attract people. So they, for example, this same town needed a doctor, a new GP in town, and they actually did a marketing campaign to Sydney and Canberra, and it was them. They had an open weekend where you and your family could come for a weekend, stay in a motel in town. All the shops stayed open and did late night things for the whole weekend. They put all sorts of things on to just show the people that were there and the diversity of the community. And they had something, the first time they did, they had something like four or five families relocate there with children, with jobs, with all of these sorts of things. And that doesn't sound like much, but if you come and plonk in a town of 6,000 people, if you come and put, say, five of those, if even only one of the couple were working in a $80,000 job, like the average salary in Australia is about $83,000. So if five people bring $83,000 a year into a town of 6,000 people, like, financially, that is a game changer. They all bring two kids each. That's 10 kids more that are going into a school, that are in the soccer team, that they then go and shop at the supermarket. Like, that real economic and cultural benefits that it has for that smaller community is just really incredible. So that's where we're being able to use towns like that town as an example to say, okay, like, you need a GP. You attract the GP to come, and in the past, what might have stopped the GP from moving in the first place, or may have had them maybe in like a fly-in, fly-out situation, was the trailing spouse. And in the past, they would be like, "Well, you take that job, and then what am I going to do in this town?" Whereas that's what this remote work sort of revolution has done, is given people the chance to say, okay, well, you go to your physical bricks and mortar office job or medical job or whatever, and the trailing spouse is like, hang on, this town's got a co-working space. Oh, they've got a business chamber that's really involved. Oh, they've got a women in business group. Like, they're doing things, and like, there is things here for me, and I can work remotely but not feel isolated and can feel part of the town. So that's really what we're really working with a lot of local governments around, like, this is, use this as a way to not only keep the people that already live there, keep them there, because it's much easier to hold on to them than attract new people. Mm-hmm. But these are the things that people are looking for if they're going to relocate, and to bring their family with them.
Outside of, like, the idea of, oh, maybe this town is a bit clicky and people are nervous about new people coming in, have you seen any other types of resistance to, like, this story and this example that you're sharing? Because it sounds really cool, and like, this idea that remote work's not just enabling remote workers to move around, but also spouses or people that have these in-person jobs coming to new towns. Like, I see so many positives in that, and I'm curious, what are the potential drawbacks?
There's always going to be some stick in the mud wherever you go. There's always going to be someone that has issue with that. I think what we find, not so much with this remote thing, but with a lot, we have a lot of migrant workers, or pre-COVID, we had a lot of, especially in our really rural towns that depend on foreign migrant workers in our agricultural industry to pick fruit and to harvest and to do all of these sorts of things. And I think on a bit of a lesser challenge, but still something that I hear, is that with this big sort of mass migration, is that expectation of the people that have left a city around the service and the type of food and coffee and, experiences and things like that that aren't quite there yet in a lot of towns. Like they're getting there, and but like I think that that sometimes almost like disappointment, like, oh, hang on, like this is the best coffee, like this is as good as it gets. Or but again, opportunity with that is they're like, okay, well, there's also three vacant buildings in this main street, like I'll put my own coffee shop in there, and then everyone has to pull up their socks. So, you know, it's that push and pull. It's a push and pull with everything. So with more people comes more services, and that's straight up. Like if you've got more people living there, they are spending money more. The health services are improved because there is more people. But again, the housing and affordability is a really big challenge as well. So yeah, push and pull.
Yeah, and that push and pull, I think, is quite interesting, like as time evolves, because I imagine, as you said, like there's these regional hubs, and how do you prevent certain areas from getting too big and maybe turning into situations where similar problems that existed in urban areas now exist just in more places around a country, versus like genuinely ensuring people are finding homes that they can build these communities where there are that balance of like charm and like slow rural life, like why people would move out to the countryside, but also enough amenities to support new people coming in, and what, yeah, like how do you find that balance? I'm especially curious, like we talked a little bit about the government's influence of that balance, but what do you think, like, should businesses have a responsibility in this like push and pull as well, as they're going to be hiring people in different places?
I think, look, yes and no. I think like with anything like this, there's going to be growing pains. Like I think that that's going to just be a thing. I think as far as the businesses that are hiring people remotely, I don't know how they so much can influence what sort of outcomes the community that their remote workers choose to live in. I don't see how they can do a huge amount there, only if they can encourage things like their staff to use co-working. Like I think that co-working, especially in rural towns, is still a relatively, like, it's not a big thing here. Like I sort of see on the things that Grow Remote in Ireland pushes out, and there's hundreds of co-working spaces in rural Ireland, and like their physical space is just so much smaller than Australia, and the uptake of co-working in those areas has just been astronomical, whereas it's really slow going here. It's happening, but it's slow. And so I think that if businesses can, I don't know, either include in packages or pay extra to encourage people to work from anywhere, not from work from home, I think that can have a really good impact. Because I think it's really interesting, like John O'Duin, who is an author of Distributed Teams, he's an Irish guy that lives in San Francisco, and he's done a lot of work in this space around decentralizing people rather than organizations. And he talks about what the impact of people seeing someone working remotely in their community. So the fact that they're not staying at home, that they're actually going and working in a co-working space in the main street, they're going and buying their coffee or their lunch from one of the local stores, and then they're having a conversation and people are like, oh, what do you do? I see you walking around. Oh, I work for a big organization, or I work for a startup or whatever. And people are sort of like, oh, that's cool. And like, and we find that we go and run a workshop in a town and people come and we do the usual whip around at the start to see what people do. And people that have known each other for years have never actually known what people did for a job, and they had no idea that they worked remotely, or they assumed that they didn't work because they hadn't seen them in a bricks and mortar store or an office or things. And they're like, oh, wow, you've got like a really important, impressive job for a company in Germany, and you're in a town of 2,000 people. And they just don't realize, because that work from home thing is very different to a work from anywhere where they're out and about, and they've got their work hat on and they've got their laptop and they're, oh, I can't talk, or I'm obviously in a meeting, like those sorts of things. And I think the last 12 months, even in small rural areas, that has opened that up a lot more, and people are seeing it now. I think that that's been a big change and a really big shift in a positive way.
Yeah. And I think that's really like a good way to articulate it, because it puts some like abilities back into people ops teams as they design benefits for remote workers. I think there's been a lot of attention, especially this year because of the pandemic and because people are working from home, of like, oh, how do we make sure people have the proper chairs to sit in when they're in their home? How can we make sure they have like a desk stipend so they can buy materials for their home? But there's been less encouragement this year. And I know it's been a big topic of conversation for those niche companies before the pandemic that allowed remote work around, do we only pay for co-working spaces? Well, then what if a town doesn't yet have a co-working space? How else can companies use their funds to make sure their remote workers are getting out in the community, whether it's like going out for lunch or having the ability to work from a cafe and using money that exists in companies to better the employee and then also have that trickle down effect on communities?
Well, I think other ways as well is like sponsorship money for sporting teams or community groups, like having then the branding awareness that comes with that as well, that that's a two birds with one stone, is that the individual employee has the ability and some cash to contribute or participate on things. But again, like, who, like a branding opportunity for a business, like how fabulous.
Yeah, I
think, and it's interesting as well, like what different governments, like I know that the state of Vermont, when they did a big push around people relocating and taking their job from interstate to relocate to rural Vermont, is that part of the program was that if there wasn't a co-working space in the town that you moved to, that the state government would dollar match you to start one. So if you then put in some, had some skin in the game and were doing it, that there was assistance. And it doesn't just have to be from the business. Like, it can be from local government, state government, federal government, from wherever that is as well.
Yeah. And then it's cool because you have the governments chiming in, the individual workers, the businesses. And that's what really, I think, is going to help shape the future of how we live as individuals, communities, companies, and all of that.
Very much so.
So I want to go back to the point around connectivity. This has come up in a few different podcasts so far. It still is an issue for people working remotely that might not always have a stable internet connection to rely on. What does that look like for the communities that Pointer Remote is involved in? And like, what do you think the path forward is? Again, I think this is an interesting question of like, is it the government's responsibility? Can businesses have a positive impact there? Like, how do we make sure like people have this? Is it now a human right that like people should have access to the internet? Like, what does this mean moving forward?
Look, it's very political in Australia. Connectivity is very political. So, look, I don't know if it's been stated as a human right. People say that. We're finding that a lot of the argument around the need for adequate connectivity in rural and remote, physically remote Australia, not remote working Australia, remote outback Australia, is that with population decline comes service decline, which means access to health services and education in particular in rural and remote community is quite, like, in some circumstances really substandard for the way that the rest of the world sees that Australia lives and behaves and runs, all of those sorts of things. So the argument around needing a strong enough connection for telehealth to try and not fill the gap, well, yes, fill the gap that physical health services are not being able to provide. Access to meaningful work, like, it impacts my community, my community of Pointer Remote quite dramatically. And I know in those first few years when I was running the business, like, it was so crazy. We physically onboarded every candidate like that was looking for a job, and we spoke to every single one of them on the phone. Like I was saying, that we tested out to see like what their internet, asked them what their internet speeds were, and actually spoke to them on the phone to sort of almost make sure that they weren't fudging through, that they had a good phone service, because I was trying to sell them as a product. I had to remove any of the people from the candidate pool who genuinely, even if they were so skilled and the most amazing person to fill a job, if their internet connection was awful, like, they just couldn't do it. If you didn't have enough of a connection to be able to FaceTime with someone, I couldn't let them onto the platform to then get all the way through the interview process, be offered a job, and then 2 weeks later the business be like, okay, these people, their internet is, they're on ADSL and they get no connection and we can't do anything, they can't download anything, they can't watch training videos, all of these things. So that is still a reality for a huge number of people here. So like I said, it is political here in that we are such a big country physically. Like Australia pretty much lays on a map over the same size as the US, except we've got the same population as LA spread across our whole country. So the infrastructure that is required to get a decent connection, if you're doing it through fiber and all the other physical infrastructure that's not satellite-wise, it's just, it's expensive. And by the time they do things, it's become almost obsolete by the time they get around and do things. So it's a really big challenge here.
Yeah.
I think I've digressed completely on your question.
But any thoughts on how to solve that challenge? Putting you on the spot.
Oh, look, this, it's so funny that I, in the last 4 years, because I was one of very few people in Oz that was championing this way of working, I've got myself quite a reputation for being quite noisy, and politicians get very irritated with me with how annoying I am as far as advocating for people that that don't have a great connection. Look, I think for a lot of people, I think according to the federally funded internet rollout, broadband rollout, apparently like 98% of Australians have access to a connection. It's just how fast it is and how expensive it is. And so I think for us, there just needs to realistically be really heavily subsidised to at least remove the cost side of things to even it out. But look, connection-wise, we just need realistically the likes of people like Elon Musk shooting lots of satellites up into the world so that there's lots of up into the sky so that there's lots of satellite connections and things, because I think the physical infrastructure is forever going to be a challenge here. I don't know how else you do it. I think just being noisy, I think having people like me that every opportunity that anytime there's a microphone in front of me, my first thing is connectivity, connectivity, connectivity. And everyone eye rolls because like everyone's always whinging about that. But like it is, I think you just have to keep saying it, and people like hearing the incidences of what happens when the connection is not good enough. But then in the flip side, saying those positives like I did earlier on around what an $80,000 salary does in these towns, like all of the other social issues and economic issues that we have in rural communities, if people are working and earning money, they are spending money, and it solves lots of problems. If people have got money, it solves lots of problems. And money doesn't buy happiness, but it definitely helps towns run a lot smoother. It helps them to drought and fireproof themselves. We've had a pretty wild few years here, even pre-COVID, as far as natural disasters, which I'm pretty sure you'd have to be living in a cave if you hadn't seen at least photos of Australia, all of Australia looking like a desert, or all of Australia on fire in the last
couple of years. I remember before COVID took over the news cycles, that was like very much something that I was seeing in the news when I was traveling to the US and South America and Europe as well.
Yeah. And it was just, oh, you've never seen before. It's just crazy. But the thing is, the towns that have been able to bounce back and have shown more resilience are the ones where people have got access to work, because if they've got money, they can rebuild. They are spending in those shops. The shops can open back up, all of those things. And so I think when people get a bit despairy about how do you do things and how do you solve the rural Australia popular problems and all those sorts of things, my argument is always put them to work. Most people want to work. Like there's only a very small part of the population in any community or parts of the world that actually don't want to work or physically can't work. Most people want to work, and most people want to do a good job. And if they're doing that, they then spend the money on the stuff that they like doing as well, which just that whole cycle, then you can stimulate economies on a really small scale. And I think that that's something that, that this remote work thing is just doing and is blowing people's minds when you look at the numbers on it. Is really crazy that the impact that just individuals working can have.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And just highlighting the other like topics or like the other areas that people might not be thinking about and how it can impact life is really important, because you think about an issue like connectivity and it's like, oh, okay, so people don't have strong internet. What does that mean? Well, like it means that telehealth does become an issue, as you said. And so I think just continuing to bring that noise to make people ask more questions is hugely important. And Elon, if you're listening, send Joe some satellites so we can get the connectivity in Australia, you know, shooting upwards.
As well, what's really interesting is that even if people have got really poor connections on their farm or on their really in their really little towns, there is always somewhere that they can drive to, even if it's not every day of the week. But we're working with like a lot of local governments who are then saying, hang on, like the connection is dreadful as soon as you leave, like 5 kilometers out of town, the phone service drops out. And you're on 3G, if that, like as far as any data that you're being able to access. But these are the ones that you then say, hang on, okay, well, hang on, you've got all the, these council-owned buildings in the main street that are either not being utilised or underutilised. Put desks in there. Crank up the internet connection. You cover it and just let your ratepayers come into town and work here. And again, you just create that co-working thing without it. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It doesn't have to be with swipe cards. It doesn't have to have an incubator and an accelerator or anything. You put 3 desks in like an office that's not being used. You watch that fill up and you watch the people making connections and talking and spending money at the cafe and doing a food shop in that town rather than driving to a bigger town further away because they're already in there. Like it's so good. And that's the stuff that we really love seeing because it's such an easy thing to do. Like
it's such an important reminder too. Like, yeah, you don't need the kombucha on tap. You don't need like the fancy like desks and the like fun paintings, though my sister who's an interior designer might argue on that point. But like, yeah, get good internet, get a few desks and see what grows as a first step. I think that's such a good reminder.
Yeah. And I think because like, I know that the business model for co-working is really tough. Like I don't know many people that run co-working spaces that are not either losing money or are having to supplement with a whole lot of other different things. But again, co-working doesn't have to be fancy. Co-working doesn't even have to have a cost. Like you do that in a small town and that's something that's just absorbed like what a bit of extra electricity and some more tea bags in the communal kitchen, like such minimal cost, but the positive outcomes that can come out of that are really, really, really amazing. Like, and that's such an easy win for little towns to be able to really impact in a positive way. And just, I don't know, that ability to, especially people when it hadn't rained, like in drought-stricken communities and you're sitting out at home and if you've managed to get an off-farm job, but doing it by yourself and having your partner come in at lunchtime and still hasn't rained and all of those mental health things that are also those mental health outcomes that can be improved if people are seeing others and all those conversation stuff. Like there's so many other benefits of having people come together to do this sort of work too.
Yeah, I feel like we could talk about this for endless hours, but alas, we don't have that much time. Before we jump into the last segment of the podcast, which is a fun game I'd like to play with you, my last question is, if you had to give very tactical advice to recruiters that work at distributed companies that want to hire talent in Australia, what should they know about hiring people that live in Australia, about common practices around salaries, around how to get in touch with those people? Like, are they on LinkedIn? Is that the best way to find these people? What should recruiters know when they want to get talent in Australia?
Well, I think a lot of the time we do get overlooked because the minimum wages and salary expectations in Australia are very high. We pay a lot of tax here, but people are generally paid well here. So that is something to keep in mind. But again, there's an element of you get what you paid for as well. So that's good. I think our time zone is something that can be leveraged really well. I think especially in those sort of customer support, say, roles and things, if you're wanting your organization to have 24-hour chat or support, all those sorts of things, really being able to leverage our time zone. English as a first language is another big thing that you can leverage here. I think as far as accessing people, LinkedIn is a really good way. People are, I think in the last 12 months, people are quite open with saying they're either unemployed or they're looking for things to work. Like that stigma around not having a job, I feel, has gone out the window globally, which is really awesome. I think, look, it's interesting. I think as far as attracting people or finding them, it's really interesting because I think a lot of Australians still don't realise how many job opportunities there are abroad. And because we're not much help to them because we've sort of had our businesses pretty much been Australian companies advertising to Australian job seekers. And so while we've definitely got scope and plans for bigger things, that's sort of, we've become very busy just doing that. So that's been fine and I'm not a huge amount of help. But in saying that, like we're always like people, recruiters globally are more than welcome to get in touch with us. We've got like a very motivated candidate pool of people looking to work. It's just that they might be quite surprised that how flexible or different that it might be working for a company that's based elsewhere. I say that, but companies like Atlassian and Canva that have put Australia on the map as far as tech companies and having sort of headquarters and big offices and staffing people here, I think has sort of started, I don't know, just putting us on the map as far as like another talent pool. Yeah, I think, definitely. Again, I think we get overlooked again a bit as well because there's not many of us. Like I said, there's only 25 million Australians, like from the babies through to the geriatrics. So there's not that many of us. Yeah, there's a motivated workforce here that are looking to do things differently. And I think that what's really interesting here is the amount of women that are looking to do things differently, that are wanting to work, that are, wanting to get back into the workforce after babies or after caring for elderly parents or things. And I think that's a global thing, but it's definitely a big thing here.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. So, yeah, all the recruiters listening today, reach out to Joe. There's awesome talent to be found in Australia. And I was laughing as you were talking about Canva because it's a product I use every day, yeah. which leads to the final game, which is Pearls of Wisdom. So in this rapid fire ending, I'm just going to give you a quick prompt and without thinking about it too much, just share the first two or three words that come into your mind. Sound good? I gave away the first one when I said Canva was one of mine, but what is your favorite remote work tool?
Trello. Slack, we're real sticklers for the comms thing and I'm very visual. So, but we also use Canva every day as well. So those are our good ones. Anything that is live, we live in Google Workspace. So we do everything in Docs and Sheets. So yeah, those are the things that we use.
Awesome. And what is your favorite way to take a break from work? You're like a break. What is that?
I'm the owner of a startup, man. What's a break? Oh, that's right. I have a break and then I have two kids. Well, actually, it's funny you say that. I have come inside to do this podcast interview, but we actually have a glamping tent set up in our paddock off the side of our house. And so we quite often will just take the kids and go and make s'mores. See my North American influence. We make s'mores than sleep in the tent. So
I'm so jealous. Yeah. I want to come over for s'mores. Sounds amazing. So segue to the next one. What is your personal biggest challenge when it comes to working remotely?
I'm pretty much the... No, actually, do you know what? I have improved out of sight, but it was very much like the do as I say, not as I do as far as self-care. And I burnt out in a big way last year. And I think that that is something that I am doing much better at managing. But I think a real mindset shift for me has been, like, I'm really active. I play sport, I walk, I hike, I ski, I do things. And I'm quite good at keeping track and keeping the physical side of body looked after, and just was not looking after the mental side of things. And so that's something that I've been doing for the last 12 months, is that I know for sort of in North America, like, having a therapist is like, everyone has a therapist and those, but that's still very much not the case here. But I have put my monthly psychologist visit into the mix, as well as Pilates on Mondays. I go to the psych every fourth Wednesday. Like, it's part of the mix now.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think is another shining light from the pandemic. As you mentioned, like, people are more open to saying when they're searching for work or unemployed. I think people are starting to be more open with their vulnerabilities and their mental health challenges when it comes to the current world that we're living in and how that impacts them at work, which I'm very 100%. Grateful for.
Yeah, 100%. And I make a point of trying to mention it literally anytime anyone's talking to me, because and people are quite surprised. I'm a really out there, outgoing person. I'm a high eye on a disc profile. Like, I am very much in people's faces and things, and they're really still on a regular basis really like, oh, God, I'm like, really? You see a psychologist? I was like, yeah, man. Like, phew, this is a mess if I don't keep this sort of reined in. So there's way too many balls in the air, and I was trying to do it by myself, which was dumb. So anyway, it's like game-changing and has been genuinely life-changing. Like, as kitsch as that sounds, like, it definitely has impacted my family life for a positive, and the business, oh my gosh, and the fact that being able to talk like that with my team as well, and all of my team, everyone's very good with the,
so much. Yeah, that's amazing. And last but not least, kind of a fun note to end on, who is someone real, fake, living or dead that you would want to co-work with in real life in your hometown or somewhere around the world you can travel to, but show them what it feels like to work in Australia?
Geez, that's a tricky one. I sort of mentioned, like, the pre-pandemic remote work crowd. Mm-hmm. I would kind of love to do like maybe it could be just a day co-working on the farm, in the tent, in the paddock. but it'd be so cool to get all of these people that I have met virtually around the world, like all these thought leaders and those sorts of things. And that's a bit corny saying that, but I would love to sort of, like, I feel that it's very, I feel that I have had a lot of exposure through people's articles on LinkedIn or blogs or videos on YouTube channels and things. I see what it's like to, say, co-work in Europe or in the US and all those sorts of things. But again, it doesn't really happen here. So it would be so cool to sort of get that crowd here and show them how we do it down under.
Yeah. Well, I would love to come. So I'm asking for an invite right now.
Done.
Perfect.
If we ever let foreigners in again, I think our borders are going to be closed for another 5 years before anyone's allowed to come again.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not. I was in Australia once back in 2012, and I only went to Sydney. And now that's like my biggest regret, is seeing like how much more of Australia there is. So we'll keep an eye out on travel restrictions, and in the meantime, you know, continue to build these virtual communities. Joe, thank you so, so much for joining us today. This is always such a blast to talk to you. If people want to learn more about your initiatives or Pointer Remote, where can they find you?
So our website is pointerremote.com.au. So you're more than welcome to have a look at that. You can find me, Joe Palmer, P-A-L-M-E-R, and it's Joe without an E, just J-O. I'm really happy to connect with people like on LinkedIn. I also am always really interested to talk to people that are interested in this rural space and what it means in rural communities, because the amount of information out there is not huge, and so it's always really cool to meet people that are doing stuff. And I'm an open book and I'm very generous with my learnings and connections and all of those sorts of things. And so it's always really great to meet people that are in that same headspace as far as sharing and collaborating and all of those good things.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And to all of our listeners out there, thank you as well. And join us next week for another episode of Distributed Discussions.